right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast, and season 39 is underway. Dom, you excited to be back in here? What's the general mood for us coming in here for this season?
Oh, effervescent. I'm overjoyed to be back here, and overjoyed to be back here with you, of course.
Okay, I am already skeptical, but yeah, I genuinely am, of course, excited to be back in here, and always, Dom, excited to be talking to you, of course, obviously, but I did want to say a couple of things just at the beginning of the show so that people have a rough idea of what they may be in for. I know a premiere may be a week where we get some new listeners, so before we dive into the actual happenings of the episode, I wanted to address a couple of quick things up front, and the first of which is something that will probably become apparent to you as you listen through however long this episode ends up going, but there is so much preseason Survivor content now. It has really taken an enormous step up over these last several years, and anyone who wants to know about all of the contestants ahead of time has probably close to like 10, at least 10 hours worth of preseason content they can be checking out on RHAP and elsewhere. I did not decide to do any of that. And the reason for that is because there's so much preseason content, and I knew I would not have time to get through all of it. It felt weird to me to go into a season knowing everything there is to know about 5 or 10 people from the cast and knowing nothing about the other 5 or 10 people in the cast. I thought it would just be a more pure kind of way of watching the season to go in just totally cold.
This is an incredibly meandering way of getting to a very simple point. Just say, I didn't do it because I didn't feel like it, and then move on. And if people don't like it, then they know where the door is. That's I feel like that's a priority too.
But it's not that I didn't feel like it. I would gladly listen to something where we know a little bit about all of the people, but 8 hours or however long is just too much for me to invest in getting to know a cast preseason. It's not going to happen.
Also, it did feel like after a point, once you got to the 12th or the 13th person down the list, you were just recycling the same cliches of, well, I don't have a great feeling about this person, but we don't know anything about them. I got a decent vibe from their 90-second video, and I could see this going well for them, but I could also see this not going well for them. Okay, great. You agree. Let's move on to the next person. And you did feel eventually like you were just kind of going through the motions a bit. So it was liberating in a way to just watch with no preconceptions whatsoever and just have a totally blank slate.
Right, and we get a lot of questions. The last year and a half or so, we have not done cast previews for exactly that reason. There's already infinite information about all of these people elsewhere, and we are like the last people who should be coming in here trying to give preseason takes when we're like the least informed Survivor fans on Twitter now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other thing that I feel is worth addressing ahead of time is something that has made me really unsure about just how excited I even was for Survivor to be back. I've honestly been kind of like dreading this moment where we have to come in here and talk about Sandra and Boston Rob being back on this season. And the reason for that is forever, I would say, and sorry in advance for this sounding weird, but like my loyalty is to the game Survivor. What interests me about this show is the social, political dynamics and people strategizing and things of that nature. And I would say pretty much anyone else you guys are hearing from, their loyalty is to Survivor staying on the air in some form or another, whatever that ends up taking, for as long as possible. And I really, really don't want to just be Mr. Negativity calling all of this garbage or whatever, because I didn't stay tuned. I don't think virtually any of this was garbage, but it is I think, going to be probably a different tone than potentially new listeners are used to from Survivor podcasts.
Oh, come on. Look, we all aspire to your level of doctrinal purity, Colin. I hope that my casualness is not too filthy for you to tolerate.
But, I mean, I don't think you are in an even slightly different boat, Dom. I think you are a lot like me where, for instance, when Big Brother clearly started going downhill, it became something that you just completely lost interest in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm on the same page as you, but I try not to make a big performance out of it, at least.
I'm not trying. That's my point. I apologized up front for how weird it would sound, but, like, I want it to be clear. I am not just coming in here trying to find reasons to complain about Survivor, but I am very willing to complain about what I think are extremely avoidable mistakes being made along the way by the people designing this show. So I'm sure that's not going to be a huge surprise to people who are regular listeners, but to any new listeners, I promise I am really not just like some 14-year-old going out of my way to say everything in the world sucks. It's it just seems to me like there are potentially some faults one might be able to find with the way this season has been structured, and that will probably be addressed a time or two over the course of this podcast. Sorry, Dom, for opening season 39 on the weirdest set of notes imaginable.
Yeah, great way to entice the new listeners, keep them in. I'm sure the acquisition as opposed to the retention is really off the charts there.
The honest advice to any new listener is just stop now. It's not going to get any better or less weird from here. If you're not into it to this point, then now would be the time to just tune us out.
Yeah, well, this is it's that old maxim of if you can't handle Colin at his worst, you don't deserve him at his best. So you're given a flavor of the first thing just so you can prepare yourself for the second.
The problem for me is the podcast audience seems to view what I would consider Colin at his worst as Colin at his best, at least in many cases, and I don't like indulging in that, and I don't want to be, like I said, I don't want to be the negative guy who just comes in and complains week after week. I think the very logical follow-up from anyone hearing someone go through that would be, why are you still watching this show? The same exact same thing we say to the people who still watch Big Brother. But I mean, the reason I still watch this show is because of how good it was without this garbage gimmick that it really seems like, I'm sure we'll get into this more, but the overwhelming takeaway, I would say, from the majority of people, at least that I've heard from, is this season would have been so much better without Boston Rob and Sandra there.
Maybe, but as you sit there wrestling with the duality of man, can we talk about some Survivor quickly?
Fine. If you insist, Dom, let's get into this season 39 premiere. So much of note here as we got a full 90 minutes to meet all of these people, and what a good job they did.
On the notes here, the first line is, I didn't know anything about these people, and you managed to stretch that into a 7.5-minute monologue. So these notes, there are several pages there. I don't know how long this is going to take, but hopefully we can pick up the pace a little bit as we get into this.
Yeah, I would say the normal amount of notes for like a 42-minute episode is somewhere between a page and a half, 2 pages, double-spaced-ish. But for here, I have pretty close to 3 pages of notes, so we may be here a while, Dom. Sorry in advance. So with that in mind, let's dive in. And right off the bat, we see a lot from Rob and Sandra. And I actually knew this was coming because the day or two before the premiere ended up airing, the opening couple of minutes were released, as they always are, to the various Survivor media outlets that are not us, that CBS has heard of and likes, had the opening 3 minutes, and it was, I did watch it. I know, Dom, you're someone who tends to want to like wait for 8 o'clock on premiere night to see those opening minutes, but I always watch them early, and right off the bat, it is clear that the Rob and Sandra impact on this season is not going to be as minimal as I had hoped, as these opening 3 minutes are almost entirely the two of them. What was your takeaway from seeing the intro to this season be almost exclusively Rob and Sandra for the opening act, at least.
I think it only makes sense, really. If you're going to invite these two headline acts back and they're going to be the stars of your season, why not use them to open the season, right? Why not use that as the hook that draws people in, especially the people who might just be channel surfing or who aren't really committed to watching a full season of Survivor these days. If they are Rob fans or Sandra fans, just seeing a glimpse of their idols will maybe entice them in for the full 14 episodes. But I think it really is just consistent with the idea of having them there in the first place, which is going to be controversial for sure. And if you don't like that, then you're probably not going to like this either. But once you take a step down that route, it makes sense to double down, I think.
Right. I completely agree with that. They are out there because the show does not have faith in the game itself anymore, and they feel like they need Rob and Sandra to be hooking casual fans in right away, and I completely understand that. And let me to add a quick addendum onto what I was saying at the top of the show. I completely understand I get that you know, being a network TV show, especially one that has run for 20 years in a crucial time slot, is going to require not always just doing what is best for the game Survivor, and that getting viewers to keep tuning in is immensely important. I just, as we'll get to, feel like this could have potentially been done in such a way where Sandra and Rob are there doing their job in that capacity, but not interfering with the main game as much as it seems like they are probably going to be over the course of this season. But yeah, I 100% understand why you would open with a bunch of Rob and Sandra to get the casual Annas of the world to refuse to tune out. But I wish, I suppose, that they had more faith in the casting and in the game itself to be interesting, that this Rob and Sandra thing just wouldn't be necessary in the first place, which I really don't feel like it is. I think this is a cast that could easily hold itself up.
Yeah, and that's the paradox here. You are, I think, most open-minded about having a radical twist like this when the cast itself could use some help, when they maybe can't carry the season by themselves. But based on what we've seen so far, and the cast always usually looks good after the first episode, so not going to commit to anything just yet, but this cast so far I've been pretty impressed by, and I would like to see them do their thing, mostly unencumbered by having to take a 10-minute detour every episode to visit Rob and Sandra, and then potentially have that be a pipeline for smuggling a ton of advantages back into the main game or anything like that. I can see that twist dragging down what otherwise could have been a great season.
Right. And so certainly nervous about that. Obviously, we haven't seen that happen yet. It just doesn't seem like an unfair assumption to think that something like that is likely to potentially go down over the course of this season. But
I would say after Edge of Extinction, there is zero benefit of the doubt. You know, even if an idea seems good on the surface, we'll believe it when we see it and then maybe give some cautious applause after that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So stay tuned for whatever cautious applause we may have for this Rob and Sandra twist at the end of the season. But at least based on the premiere, and this is totally a testament to how good this cast looked, I would say Rob and Sandra over the course of this season may be actively making it worse, but we will obviously see how that ends up going. And I was, like I said, really nervous about coming in here and talking about all of this, and I was trying to like mentally prepare myself to be less negative and jaded and try to put a more positive spin on everything, but I'm off to a horrible start, so fuck it. We're just going we're going hard on this first episode, and hopefully over the course of this season I can kind of get used to this and tone it down a bit. Anyway,
wait, you didn't like this first episode?
I did like this first episode, but that's why it is all the more infuriating to me that every one of these episodes is going to be marred by this completely unnecessary gimmick.
Yeah, so that's the second line of the notes here, and we're clocking in just about 15 minutes now, so very on pace so far. I'm going to try and keep that up.
Has it really been 15? Jesus, it's already been 15 minutes.
Well, when you're in flow state, Colin, when you're really just enjoying what you're saying, it's easy for the time to pass you by. So meanwhile, those of us like me who have to sit here listening to this are fully cognizant of the amount of time that's passing. But that opening sequence was interesting, not just because of the abundance of Sandra and Rob, but the total lack of Jeff Probst, who was reduced to this disembodied voice for the short intro, and then we just cut straight to the action. There's no marooning, no intro, there's no him trying to get them hyped up and they all go wild clapping, and then he introduces the theme of the season. None of that. We just get we get straight to it, which I kind of liked. And I don't know if this is Jeff trying to demonstrate to all of us how much we miss him when he's gone or anything like that, but I worry that might have backfired, because if this becomes the new standard, then we're going to see a lot less of Jeff Probst in the opening minutes.
Are you out on that? Do you want Jeff there holding your hand visually the entire way through the beginning?
I don't mind it. I don't hate it as much as some people seem to, but it does mean that the opening is a little bit disjointed when we just see a tribe walking to a beach. And I can imagine if you're a viewer who is channel surfing or just happened to be picking up the show for the first time, you see that and you think that you must have missed something, right? You tuned out during a crucial moment, or you've missed some crucial setup that's going to let you understand what's happening here, because it does take for granted now, and maybe it's fair to, that you understand what the premise of the show is, and you're invested enough to care who Sandra and Rob are and to be excited that they're back, and to just commit to everything and hit the ground running, which I don't know how safe that is to assume for a lot of people.
Right. So I personally was a huge fan of having no marooning here. And I know part of this is because it was a 90-minute episode, but I thought having no marooning went an enormous way in opening the door for us to meet a lot more of these people than we generally do during a Survivor premiere. And it seemed to me like that was the pretty overwhelming takeaway, at least from my Twitter timeline, is that going back away from the marooning after a really long streak, I feel like there'd been a marooning every season since at least like 31. I think this is something that we will probably continue to see in the future. Maybe not for all winners, because that's such an iconic group that you probably want to assemble on the mats, day one, minute one, and let everyone look around and so forth and get some commentary from them before the game has even begun. But for newbie seasons, I could very easily see them going away from the marooning again for a long time.
Yeah, I think the issue for me is that the marooning just doesn't have anything special about it anymore. There's no hook that makes it seem like a really fun event to lead into the season. And they've tried to spice it up over the course of 30-something seasons, where you would have an advantage that's hidden either on the boat or in one of the items that they take with them, or if you're the first to race to the beach or whatever, then you get a necklace, or something else happens, or there's like a challenge that happens right there as soon as they get there. But none of that has re-energized it the way that you would really need it to. And when you think back to some of the more memorable seasons, or some of the more memorable moments from unmemorable seasons, a lot of those involve marooning. So for the patron bonus content rewatches at the moment, we're going back through Guatemala, where by and large that season hasn't made a strong impression on anyone, but that brutal 11-mile hike at the start is the one event. It's like the singular thing that people really latch onto about that season. And then you look back at Sandra's first season in Pearl Islands. That was a compelling season from pillar to post. But the thing that immediately made viewers realize that they were onto something special here was that amazing marooning in the town, where they had to just go around and haggle and barter for items, and then like Vanuatu as well. And it feels like in recent years, like in this decade basically, we just haven't had anything that adventurous or exciting, and I'm not sure what they could really do with that, but if they really can't think of anything, then maybe it is time to just do away with it altogether.
Right, and I'm totally with you that a marooning is awesome, and has been awesome many times in the past, but now that every single season is in Fiji, it seems like things like going into the town to haggle with the locals are pretty much off the table. There's no 11-mile jungle through which to walk. What I am, I guess, objecting to is standard kind of marooning we've seen the last few years, where everyone's just on the boat with Jeff, and he gives you some super generic kind of welcome to Survivor. We meet a couple of people who are probably going to go on to be obvious main characters, and then everyone runs around off on the boat for a couple minutes, gathering supplies, and then jumps off, and they're paddling back to their camp as we hit the first commercial break or whatever. I think while it was exciting after, you know, however many years of not having any kind of marooning from when, let's say, Samoa through One World, there was, I think, a pretty long streak of no marooning, and then it came back in Philippines. I would say at this point, the boat scramble has been overdone.
Yeah, and as you say, there's a need to change things up and to add new elements to the show, and this is the one thing which feels like it was stuck in the past for a long time, so maybe this isn't nearly as radical a step as we're making it out to be. Mm-hmm. But marooning or lack thereof aside, we get straight to the action here, and one of the first people that we meet really is Vince, who is going around making friends. We have the opening confessional from Karishma, and then the two of them kind of link up and start chatting, and I love that when they're talking about their respective backgrounds, he says, "I'm Hmong. Most people don't know what that is." And then instead of enlightening the audience, 99% of whom are also not going to know what that is, they just cut away and just leave us on the hook until later on in the episode where they decide to fill us in finally.
Yeah, they may as well have had Vince turn to the camera and just say, "Google it," which I did, because I had obviously not heard of, the Hmong people. Were you familiar, Dom, with the Hmong people?
I was, but I feel like there's no good answer here, because if I say no, you're going to make me sound ignorant, and if I say yes, you're going to be like, oh, well, classic Dom, just pretending to be over-educated or something. So really, I should take the neutral box on this option. I just say, I had an inkling, but I wasn't very sure. The name sounded vaguely familiar.
So for me, the name sounded vaguely familiar, but I would not have been able to come up with it myself. For you, I was expecting, to give you some credit here, Dom, I thought you would be able to tell me about, like, the entire political history of whatever area that is.
Well, join our Patreon for the bonus content on that. if you want a special episode, just let us know. We'll make it happen. I thought that was kind of cute. And then Karishma ended up not being, like, a massive presence in the episode, just like no one did, really. It was a very balanced distribution of screen time, I thought. But it felt like between this kind of early first impression here, and then at Tribal, when Rob and Sandra seem pretty approving of her from their spot in the goggle box up on high, it seemed like she might be a character to watch this season.
Yeah, definitely. And the big takeaway I had as we were meeting all of these people at the beginning of the game, and I certainly was not alone in noticing this. This was a story on my Twitter timeline as well that people were very into, as was I, based on these last, 20 years or so of Survivor history. I thought it was very noteworthy how much emphasis there was on the women of this season very early on. Like, I was shocked when you said we meet some people, and the first one I want to talk about is Vince, because he was like the only guy who got any content during the first.
Just shoving me under the bus right away.
No, literally, all of the women in the cast had at least one confessional by the time we hit the second commercial break. And during the first act here, it is, apart from Vince, just a string of like six women in a row introducing themselves.
Yeah, there have been seasons in the past where you could not have said that four episodes into the season. And not all of them were like big figures in this episode. Some of them were more prominent than others. And then obviously One Tribe goes to Tribal, so we're going to have more focus on that beat rather than the other one. But yeah, it was a pretty even balance there. And even balance, not just like in individual terms, but in gender terms as well. You for once had the women like actually being heard in the early parts of the premiere here. So Karishma was the first to lead into that, and then immediately followed up by many others, including Elizabeth, who I don't know if she was pegged like Danny Boatwright style as a former Olympian, or if she decided to just divulge that right away, but it seemed like that was just immediately an open secret.
So again, I do not know anything about Elizabeth's backstory or her history as a Survivor fan, but I think I have heard that she was one of the people not super familiar with the show, and thus it's pretty funny that she was the first one sent to go meet up with Boston Rob and Sandra, whom she seemed to recognize. But it would have been funny if the very first person out there pretty much didn't know who they were.
I have a strong feeling that Heroes vs. Villains might have been the season they were given to watch in sequester, just to make sure that that couldn't happen for anybody.
That makes sense. And I think I had heard that she was trying to keep the former Olympian thing under wraps and just caved as soon as someone asked her about it once. I don't think anyone recognized her. I don't think anyone would ever recognize any Olympic swimmer not named Michael Phelps. But I think that when asked, she just immediately bailed on the plan to lie. And I think that was probably a good decision, because it's not like being a former Olympic swimmer is going to be something that is threatening. If anything, I would say that's probably going to be something that most of the tribe would deem as a very good quality to have in a tribe mate, especially early on.
Well, looking at the precedent here, after Shane Gould's amazing win, Olympic swimmers are one for one, I believe. So maybe that is more threatening than they're giving it credit for. But yeah, I don't know if it was someone who just recognized her because they themselves are a competitive swimmer, or they just have this encyclopedic knowledge of Olympic sports or whatever. But either way, that was on the table very early, and once that is on the table, there's no point in trying to like Gary Hoger boom it, right? You really have to just be open. And to be fair, this is a good look for Elizabeth, which she will then destroy utterly with some terrible lies later on in the episode. So she starts strong and then maybe starts to slide down afterwards.
More on that for sure later, because when she does end up lying to them about Boston Rob and Sandra, that is encased in multiple confessionals from her talking about how the last thing she wanted to do was lie. And I feel like this opening scene is kind of proof of that, that even something she had planned on going in and trying to keep to herself, she, as soon as she was asked about it, decided to just be honest. So keep that in mind when we get there later.
I was going to say, too, it was interesting that she had this confessional early on where she said that after the Olympics, she was trying to find a new direction to take her life in and a new place for herself. And it's interesting to think, not just with her, but with some of the other Olympians that we have on the show, or there was this Twitter thread recently about a documentary about Andrew Wiles, who I would guess you're maybe 7% to have heard of.
Say the name one more time. Sorry, I was coughing as you said that.
Andrew Wiles?
0% to have heard of.
Okay, sure. So he was a guy who made this incredibly important discovery in mathematics, which until that point he devoted his entire career to. And then once it happened, it's like, well, that is the first line of my obituary that has just been written right there. That is the peak of my career. What am I meant to do now? Right. And it's the same way for the Olympians here, or really anyone who achieves this amazing feat in anything competitive. It's like you reach the goal that you've devoted your career to, and then you're just casting around aimlessly for some new adventure to go on. And so Survivor's a pretty good one to slot in there, I guess.
What is, do you know Elizabeth's current line of work?
No idea whatsoever.
Because I do not imagine that being a former Olympic swimmer is continuing to pay the bills. And so I'm guessing for most Olympians who are not Michael Phelps in the swimming game, their next act after being an Olympian is find a job.
Well, I think the thing on their, I guess in their obituary, but also on their chyron on Survivor, will always be former Olympian. And
she's probably a swimming coach, it would be my guess.
I was going to say, I didn't want to just jump to conclusions, but that seemed to be the safe choice there. But for Shane Gould, who I think was in her 50s or 60s, like that's obviously a much more relevant question than Elizabeth, who maybe this is a recent accomplishment, and so she doesn't feel the pressure to commit to something new just yet.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Maybe is her swimming career actually over?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, is Shane Gould's swimming career over? I mean, Shane Gould could be out there in 2020.
Don't hold your breath, Colin.
Okay. So a couple other people that we get to meet early on that stood out to me. We meet Missy and hear a bit about her backstory, but I will say the one piece of pregame reading I did was Mike Bloom's interview with Missy. Mike was out there on location, along with, you know, Josh and everyone else that's always out there. And I would strongly recommend for anyone who hasn't seen it yet to go and check that out, because we got a little taste of Missy's backstory with her tumor in particular and everything that kind of put her through as she was dealing with that. But it is crazy, the full story. So do give that a Google if you would be interested in finding out more. And of course, Dom, if she's out there in her first confessional making puns like Soul Survivor, S-O-U-L, Survivor, she's of course going to be my early favorite.
Just any wordplay at all is enough to clear that bar.
Yeah, for sure. And incidentally, the next person we hear a little bit from is Molly, who is a law student rather than a law school student, Dom. I'm taking full credit for that being right to be being back to being right. Yeah, dubious it seems on your end there, but anyway, the other person that I thought really stood out early, and I am so excited to see what more she brings to this season, we see Janet, who I'm guessing a lot of people would take one look at and not really think much of in the context of being a Survivor player out there on the mat, just based on the history of the Janet type over the course of the last couple of decades. But Janet, comes out here like an absolute boss. She's immediately making fire with only bamboo and coconut husk, and then we'll later go on to see in the challenge she nails the hook or whatever it was on the first attempt. Janet, an early standout for me. What did you think of Janet?
Yeah, Janet really forcing people out there to tell on themselves if they come after her this early. But yeah, she knows how these things usually go. And one response to that might be to just shrink back and avoid any attention whatsoever insofar as you can, and just hope that someone else implodes, which sure enough they do early on. But Janet decides, I'm going to make a good first impression before that natural first impression has any time to form. I'm going to make fire and prove myself, and she does. So it feels like she's going to be, hopefully, at least, I don't want to jinx her, but hopefully in a solid spot here going ahead.
Yeah, definitely. And Chelsea, obviously quite visible. She was like the one person who was allowed to talk at the beginning of the episode as Boston Rob and Sandra were getting all of the screen time. She, while no specific things really stood out, it seemed like someone who was at least there and had a solid enough head on her shoulders throughout. So definitely got an eye on Chelsea. And the other thing I wanted to address.
Yeah, well, Chelsea, yeah, she seemed very, very peppy, very smart. And I know she was someone who had a lot of preseason buzz around her too. And it feels like she and Molly on opposing tribes are going to be kind of like the copies of each other, but like the twins, if you like, where they're both in that same archetype and could end up teaming up and being the dream team. And I'm sure Twitter would love that. But also I could see them realizing that, like, hey, this the other one is the biggest threat to fill my role, and I have to cut them as soon as I can, as soon as they meet.
Mm-hmm. So the other person that I liked and sympathized with a lot early on was Lauren, who gave a confessional saying, "The theme is Island of Idols, which sort of makes your mind go wild, especially, I would say, when you don't have a marooning and you don't have Jeff Probst explaining to you what this theme might mean." I am guessing that was at the forefront of most of the conversations for the opening days, is what is this theme all about? And I am positive if I showed up there and saw Island of the Idols written on the flag for my tribe, and knowing that was going to be the theme of my season, I would be going insane within the first 2 days. There's no question about it.
You would have a Shane Powers-esque meltdown just right there on day one.
Zero doubt. Like, people think I exaggerate about how bad I would be at Survivor, but like, this would just make my mind explode on the first day. I would be so tilted to see that the theme was Island of the Idols, as if that's the direction that Survivor needs to be heading. But anyway, a lot of focus, as we said, on a lot of these women early on, which is great. And another one who stood out a little later, but for most of the back half of the episode, I'm going to call the episode one America's player kind of winner, Elaine. Dom, what did you think of Elaine?
I loved Elaine. Yeah, she seemed like the happy version of Lauren almost. I know that's sort of strong Rimmer vibes going on there. But I can see her being a fan favorite in almost the same way. Whereas with Lauren, it was, despite her very gruff exterior, you could tell that there was something really quite lovable underneath. And with Elaine, there's no exterior at all. It's just that's just who she is. And everyone fell in love with her immediately, which is why Ronnie decided to just jump to level 5 immediately and try and target her on day one.
Yeah, I definitely remember. It was either in the podcast about the episode where Lauren was eliminated from Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, or in that Season in Review podcast. I said, I think Lauren Rimmer could be a new archetype on this show, and based on Elaine in the premiere, and the overall kind of positivity that I think many audience members probably came away from this episode feeling from her, she seems like someone to keep an eye on. And if she does go on to have a fun, deep run here, I think lock it in that this is going to become a new person we're going to see regularly on Survivor.
Yeah, and Lauren herself was not taken all that seriously at first in game terms, but proved to be, you know, in the mix post-merge, taken out as one of the bigger threats. And Elaine seems too cheery, I guess, to immediately be pegged as a threat, unless you're Ronnie. But she was very quick to see right through him and to have a good read that she was in danger. People were coming after her. But then her social game was strong enough that people didn't want to lose her and went out of their way to keep her. So really great signs early for her, too.
Yeah, absolutely. We see early on that Orange team that Elaine and Vince and Tom go off by themselves. And at least as far as the TV narrative is concerned, they kind of draw some attention for doing so. And Ronnie and Aaron start trying to rally this big group around those three kind of being on the outs. I am reluctant to believe that everyone was as interested in isolating those three as Ronnie and Aaron probably were, and that was primarily to make this more suspenseful for the TV episode. But where were you on that? Did that strike you as a situation where Elaine and company were genuinely potentially in trouble if the Ronnies of the world had potentially played this a bit differently?
To a point, I think it's just the usual day one thing where everyone is just looking for a name to throw out there. And I'm sure Elaine's name was thrown out and seemed like it might be in danger at various times. But then it just rebounded onto, they thought it was going to switch to Vince, but instead it rebounded on Ronnie. And I'm sure names other than Ronnie came up at the same time. Like nothing is that certain early on. So maybe there was some danger, but it felt like Elaine was always going to be there for the long haul.
Yeah, there were probably a million different plans made, especially on a season called Island of the Idols, where no one knows how that twist works yet.
Oh, especially as well, once Elizabeth comes back, what is the like percentage you're assigning to her to have some kind of advantage of some kind?
Overwhelming is the answer to that. I don't have an exact number, but yeah, absolutely feeling like Elizabeth, based on this story that she's giving us about Island of the Idols, is essentially the exact same thing as Ghost Island, just rebranded. That story is not checking out ever for me.
I would not put that past them, first of all, so maybe I would buy into it. I would be the gullible one here. But yeah, that was not a great sign. And it feels like whoever got sent there the first time was kind of hard done by in a way, because there's not really anything they could say coming back that would make any sense. Like, I saw so many people criticizing Elizabeth on Twitter for not coming up, for either not telling the truth or not coming up with a better lie. But the truth is less plausible than even the worst lie could possibly be. Right? Like, you come back and you say, well, as my boat turned around the corner, I saw a giant 20-foot-tall totem of Sandra's head. And then lo and behold, there was Sandra. You would think, okay, she's going loopy. Ronnie, you're safe. This one needs to be carted back to Ponderosa and then to an asylum post haste. But that's actually true. And I kind of love the idea that I saw someone float of you send Elizabeth out there. She goes through this incredibly bizarre experience with Rob and Sandra. And then once she goes back, you tear all of that down, and then the next person who goes out there, if Elizabeth tells the truth, she just now looks completely balmy, and they're all wondering how that even entered her mind.
So I would say, let's get into that now, the Island of the Idols visit and so forth. I would say Elizabeth going back and giving the true story is something that is so crazy and immediately falsifiable by anyone else who goes there in the future, if that turns out to not be the case, that she basically can't be making this up. There's no way she would go right that off the deep end if this was a lie. The issue,
if it's very basic, you assume, well, okay, that story checks out, may as well be true. If it's slightly implausible, then it seems like a bad lie, and you see right through it. But then if it's so wildly implausible that no one could ever actually think of that by themselves unless they smuggled drugs into the, past the screeners or whatever. Then you think, well, we may as well believe them, because if they're wrong, then it's obviously going to come out at some point. You can't maintain that lie and have everyone believe it for 39 days. And if it's true, then I don't want to be the one who doubted her when she was just being sincere and being honest with us.
Right. And I would say, in terms of what Elizabeth should do, if I went out there and I was the first one to go to the Island of the Idols and I then was faced with what to tell my tribe, there is a 100, and I mean 100% chance I am being fully honest about as many details as I possibly can, and because I know that this is going to be something that someone else is going to go to 3 days from now, and someone's going to go 3 days after that, and someone's going to go 3 days after that, and when it's day two or day three, I'm still in the middle of making a first impression, and the last thing I would ever want to do is draw any sort of suspicion. Full disclosure is an absolute no-brainer here. If you are the person who is being sent back, having just met with Rob and Sandra, the issue...
Well, I know some people were wondering if she was actually allowed to divulge all of that.
Correct.
Because surely that would be the simplest route, right? Is to just tell the unvarnished truth. And so when she comes up with what is clearly just a preposterous lie, you have to wonder if you're being at all charitable to her or at all generous. You have to think, well, maybe she just literally can't tell them what happened, and this is the best she could come up with in the heat of the moment. But Mike Bloom, who was actually out there on location at the time, has confirmed that, no, she was able to tell whatever she wanted. Rob and Sandra preferred to keep their existence there under wraps for the time being, but there was no requirement on her, so she could have said whatever she wanted and just decided that this was the best option somehow.
So that is not the account that I saw pregame in some Dalton Ross article where they, in some interview, Probst is, it literally says, we essentially brought in Boston Rob and Sandra to be producers on this season, and it is Boston Rob and Sandra's job to get these people to not share this secret. It is essentially, this is what is happening, and there is no doubt in my mind that this is what is happening, and you will be able to confirm that this is what is happening as every subsequent person goes back and has to come up with some lie. The producers are forcing them to lie about this, and that is fucking insane to me, that you are asking this person to jeopardize their own game so you can protect your production secrets. That is, apart from any instances of them, for instance, like Ben Dreebergen or whatever, things just so grotesque in terms of just taking $1 million away from someone to give it to someone else. I would say essentially demanding that these players lie to protect your production secrets is one of the worst things the producers have ever done. And sorry to Mike Bloom, if Mike ends up being...
Okay, hold on. It would be if that's what was going on. Where is this coming from? What are you basing any of this on at all?
I can't draw up the specific, but this will be, Dom, listen, this will be the determining factor. Anyone who is not brand new to the game Survivor will immediately know. I should obviously be honest about what I just went through. I am guessing no one will go back there until many people have gone, and it's kind of, too many people, until we get to the point where people are on the same tribe who have both been to visit Rob and Sandra, no one will be allowed to talk about Rob and Sandra being out there, and it would be frustrating beyond words. And if I were in Elizabeth's spot, when they pull me aside and say, hey, you really shouldn't talk to people about what you just went through, like, we'd really like to keep this a secret, my reaction is absolutely fucking not. I don't care.
Hold up. So, first of all, what's obvious to you might not always be obvious to other people. And that's a good maxim for here and for life, just in general. Like, I agree that it seems silly to not at least be honest in some way. You don't have to tell everything, but at least, you know, be as open as you feel like you can be. But that might not be obvious to Elizabeth. She might see things in a completely different way, or there might be other factors we're not seeing that would lead her to want to try and lie instead. Or maybe
if only we had, Dominic, if only we had four different instances in this episode of Elizabeth in confessional saying, the last thing I ever want to do is lie to my tribe.
Okay, but that is also the exact kind of thing where when they're trying to sell a narrative, they have Elizabeth saying, the last thing I ever want to do is lie, but in this case, I feel like I can, and they just chop it up, Frankenstein it, and then move it along to package what they do. Like, that's the exact kind of thing where if you were trying to make the exact opposite argument, you would be in here saying, well, clearly that's not representative of her entire thought process, and we can't take any of that for granted. But that, so don't come at me with that. But then also, like, what do they have to gain from conceding Rob and Sandra being there in that way and jumping through so many hoops and, as you see it, impugning the entire integrity of their show just to disguise that for a few more days?
I am guessing they want everyone when they arrive to freak out at seeing, oh my God, Boston Rob and Sandra have been here the whole time. It is not nearly the same TV moment if people show up and already know that Boston Rob and Sandra are there.
Okay, but they're going to freak out regardless because the entire concept is completely absurd. And for some of them, that they will be starstruck to see, you know, the two-time winner in Survivor history, the best player of all time, and also Boston Rob. So, you know, I think you don't need to manufacture that suspense or that surprise and excitement. It's just going to be there no matter what. So this, like, just deranged conspiracy theory, I don't know, it seems excessive to me, to put it mildly.
I could not be more convinced that they are being forced to lie.
I mean, okay. Granting that for the moment, right, if you're forced to lie, you can tell a fairly simple white lie, right? Like, you can say, I was told I had to compete in something, or you can just essentially replicate what happened on Ghost Island, right? I went there, I was given a choice where I could either take the one of two boxes, or I could I was given the opportunity to compete, I chose to compete, and I lost, so I sacrificed my vote or something. Or, you know, you can find a way to frame it where it doesn't seem strange or that threatening, but then also, once the truth comes out, you weren't lying, you were just obscuring the details. But
so what is the line on when Boston Rob and Sandra being out there becomes public knowledge to the people in the game? I am guessing.
It seems... like, okay, so even if there was, like, an edict from up on high forbidding them from talking about Rob and Sandra, they're going to be discussing it in some kind of coded terms. Like, the people who went there, they're going to be comparing notes. And if they're not explicit about it, they will be implicit about it, I suppose. So that information will find a way to seep out from, you know, if people want it to.
I suspect we are in store for everyone who goes there until quite a ways into this just magically decides that their best move is to lie about it.
Okay, if you say so.
I am so willing, and I pray that we show up next week, someone else goes to visit Rob and Sandra, they come right back and they tell the whole group, and obviously I'm a moron for having said any of this in the first place.
I would like nothing more.
I highly doubt that is going to happen. I think we are looking at least like episode 5, 6, somewhere in there, before a couple of people even acknowledge to each other, knowing full well that they've both been there on screen, that this is what is going on.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see clips of people discussing it, but I think it will be discussed. And it's going to be like, so if they want to talk about it, they will find a way to talk about it. It is impossible to keep that lid on it forever. And if you are the producers, it seems like a lot of work to forbid everyone from talking about it and then have to detect and crack down on people just, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, implying things about it, just for the sake of getting a momentary shot of someone looking a little bit more surprised when they get to the island for the first time.
I agree. It's completely insane, but that is what is happening.
Okay.
Stay woke, Dom. That's a stay woke. Anyway, so all right. Let's let's close out the Island of Idols while we're on here. We end up seeing Boston Rob and Sandra teach Elizabeth how to make fire, and then they tell her, "All right, here's your opportunity now. If you want to go for it, you're going to take on Boston Rob in a fire-making challenge, and if you win, you're going to get an idol that can be used for your next two or three votes. I forget which one. And if you lose, you're going to lose your vote here." And obviously, right off the bat, this seems like an offer the producers can't possibly have thought would be fair or accepted. But in Elizabeth's case, it really seems like they are able to talk her into taking this offer. We see Boston Rob say, "Hey, you said you're in a good alliance, so your vote probably won't even matter tonight. What do you think? You want to give it a shot?" And it seems to me, if you watch this video, she's nodding and saying yes because she feels like that's what they want her to say.
Oh, so you think this was also all pre-scripted in advance too?
No, I don't think they said you have to say yes, but I think she clearly was picking up on the vibe that it's not a compelling start to the season if she just declines this option. And of course, this is an unwinnable battle. And the part that I don't even blame her necessarily for saying yes to this, because I do believe that there was a lot of pressure that she was feeling. And again, I'm not saying they were explicitly saying you must do this, but I feel like she got the vibe from every single person on that beach that this is what they want her to do. She's new to this show. What the hell? Maybe this is a standard thing that people do. Maybe Boston Rob will take a dive, whatever. She ends up agreeing. And then after hearing this oath of the idols about how everything that happens out here is to make you a better Survivor player, once this very first invitation is accepted, smash cut to Boston Rob saying, "Oh, she took the first offer," not even thinking to question if I might have something in my back pocket.
Could we talk about that for a second? Because that I was peeved by that.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah, if it's just a binary choice, if it's do you want to compete or do you not, then fair enough. But for Rob to get on her back for not expecting that wasn't actually the choice, and that actually she was going to be able to haggle with Rob for better terms or whatever, that is preposterous. That is so unfair to Elizabeth.
But it's out of the realm of possibility that they're telling her she has to lie?
No, it's Jesus. Oh, God.
Anyway. I hope I'm wrong about that. I hope we come in a week or two from now, someone blows the lid off of it, and I will have an immense amount of respect for that player. I am convinced Elizabeth in particular was strongly suggested to her that lying would not be wise, or would be the only wise move. Excuse me, that telling the truth would not be wise.
Okay.
Anyway. Fine. I'm sure we will follow up on that in future weeks. But yeah, utterly insane that she should be expected to say, "Well, sorry, what's your second offer here, Boston Rob?" I think you're right. I don't know if we've ever seen a challenge in the history of Survivor where you could negotiate at the difficulty level.
Yeah, and whenever someone takes the initiative to negotiate with outside the game items with Jeff, like the rice situation in San Juan del Sur or whatever, he always looks like they've just slapped him in the face or said something highly insulting to him. It's really crossing a boundary to even broach that subject with him. So yeah, for Elizabeth to have the moxie when she isn't that familiar with Survivor and when no one is familiar with this entire concept, it's not even like she's heard several different accounts of people who have been through this process before, and then she decided maybe I should mix this up a bit. She is the first person that this is being tried on. So to get on her back for not trying to like upend the entire concept is kind of silly to me.
The thing for me is like, we don't hear what Boston Rob's backup offer would have been, but the idea that even a Survivor superfan would have the right. audacity to want to make fire against Boston Rob in the first day or first couple of days that they're out there on the island is preposterous. And like the only thing I can think of is that this was a test of like today's lesson is know your limitations and obviously don't accept this completely suicidal challenge of making fire against Boston Rob.
That's one worry that I do have with this is if this becomes like a parable for the way that you're actually meant to play Survivor back on the island, because in some cases that is explicitly what it's going to be. It's we're going to teach you how to lie within the game or how to keep your cool under pressure, and that obviously has applications for playing the game of Survivor. But with stuff like this, if this was just if this becomes a metaphor for, well, you can't accept the first offer that you're given when there is no way for her to know that another offer is on the table. It's not about Elizabeth, but it's just throwing her underneath the bus to make a point. But also, like, what other offer could Rob have given her that would even make sense for her to accept? Let's say there's a handicap in the challenge, right, where Rob only gets a start after X minutes. How high does X have to be for Rob still not to be the overwhelming favorite in that challenge?
It would probably have to be like Rob can only use bamboo is the is the backup offer. But I like.
And let's say she it has the gumption to actually try that. You know that Rob is going to turn it back on her and just say that it's ridiculous that she would even suggest such an insulting offer or whatever. Like they can find a way to spin it in a way where Rob looks like, you know, the sage elder who knows everything, and Elizabeth is just the young whippersnapper who is wet behind the ears.
I would say there is. I would guess Rob and Sandra, not just this season but also next season, essentially are bulletproof in terms of being made to look like morons whenever they are potentially eliminated from all winners. I think whatever happens to Rob and Sandra on that season, they will look good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, there goes our first visit to the Island of Idols, Elizabeth.
Hold on, not quite, because before we visit the Island of the Idols, we need to learn just exactly what it is. And so we have this nice little opening montage introducing Rob and Sandra, or reintroducing them for many of us. And I did think it was a little quizzical that they, when they were saying, we've both won the game, we've both lost the game, is they showed Rob's one win out of four and Sandra's one loss out of three, as if, like, if you were randomly choosing a permutation of their wins and losses, you would have to click refresh quite a few times before you ended up with that one.
There's only a 1 in 12 shot of that, Dom. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It stood out to me as well when he said, we both won the game. I thought we were going to cut to, okay, here's Rob winning the game, and now here's Sandra winning the game twice. And instead, we cut to Sandra getting her torch snuffed.
Yeah, so not quite sure what editorial stance that's suggesting, but worth keeping track of.
Impossible to read into, Dom. So the other thing I wanted to say, actually, about Island of Idols, what did you think of the mechanism to determine who gets sent there, where it is a random draw from the team that ended up losing the immunity challenge? And then we'll see at the end of this, Elizabeth is going to pick a random person who is from the other team, I think by necessity, to visit the island next. Did you read anything into that, the way that they're determining who goes?
No, I think because it's so early and there's so much going on, they want to simplify it as much as they can and just move it along. I could see maybe later on one tribe will be asked to pick someone from the losing tribe or something. But this early, those choices would effectively be random anyway. And so I don't mind them just taking that out of the equation entirely.
So I would say I think what they are trying to prevent is the same person going back repeatedly by letting the other tribe choose. And also, I think them insisting that no matter how the next challenge goes, it will be someone from the other team going here next is clearly, as far as I'm concerned, an effort to keep this a secret as long as possible and ensure that only one person from each of these tribes knows anything for at least the first 6 days.
But that also makes sense, because if one tribe just wins several challenges in a row, then you don't want the Island of the Idols to be exclusively within the purview of the other tribe, right?
Why? So why not Ghost Island?
because who's happy with the way that Ghost Island turned out? This feels like you're taking something which is completely innocuous and is ideal anyway if you're thinking about it, and finding a way to construe it in the worst possible interpretation.
I find it interesting that for the first time ever, this is the way they are doing things with the twist.
So they can't make an effort to ever improve anything because it has to be part of some larger conspiracy?
No, it remains to be seen, first of all, if this is an improvement. I like the dynamic of people on either their own tribe or the other tribe having to choose, knowing who's been there before and what the dynamics are on the tribe, who is going to go spend time isolated.
Sure. It wouldn't shock me either if when the pendulum swings back to this tribe, if Elizabeth's name is just not in the back so that they can have some more variety and they don't send her back there again, unless that's what they want, which I guess it could be. It might be fun to see her wrestle with that choice, knowing how badly it turned out the first time.
I think it's a foregone conclusion that Elizabeth's name will not be in the bag. They want different people going.
Okay, well, this directly goes against your conspiracy, because if they were trying to keep this under wraps, then they would do everything they could to make sure the same person was sent back there as often as possible.
It goes directly with my conspiracy, because they want as many people as possible showing up shocked to see Boston Rob and Sandra.
Okay, sure, if you say so.
That's what it is. All right, so...
Let's talk about the choices here, too, because in reality, Elizabeth is going to have her clock cleaned by Rob no matter what the challenge is if she accepts that choice. But let's say it was just flipping a coin or something. In a way, it might be good to lose your vote here, right? Like that's not actually that big of a downside, because it means you can't prove yourself to whichever group you would end up voting for. But if you would have been on the outs, if you would have voted with the wrong group and got blindsided, then you now get to hide that. You get to pretend that you would have been with the majority the whole time. If you were, let's say, pledging your vote to both sides, you now don't actually have to follow through on either half of that.
So this ties into something that is going to come up much later, but when people cast no votes on Survivor, I don't believe Jeff has ever shown that to the tribe. They just put their no vote in the bucket and it never comes up. On international versions, when someone casts a no vote, that is the first vote that is pulled out of the bucket. It is made clear to everyone in the game, someone did something to lose their vote tonight. And if Elizabeth could go into, or come away from, I guess, Island of Idols, knowing she's lost her vote, I think that means, if she thinks that no vote will be announced at Tribal Council tonight, that completely changes the story that she has to give. I think at that point, she has to say, I played a game and I lost, and that's why I lost my vote. But the good news, guys, is obviously I don't have anything. And I would, if I were Elizabeth, actively want this no vote to be shown.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. And then on the flip side, with the idol, which only is good for two tribals, you can see that as either if you need the idol that soon, then you're likely doomed regardless, and buying yourself 3 days isn't going to help you. I guess unless there's a swap around the corner, in which case that could upend the entire game. But then the flip side of that is losing your vote probably is not going to matter too, unless the margin is so thin that your vote makes all the difference. Right. So this is unlikely to be too consequential regardless. And Elizabeth, so far at least, seems like no one really has a problem with her, and she seems inoffensive enough that it's hard to imagine someone developing a problem with her. So as long as she's on the right side of the vote, she should be pretty safe for the time being, idol or no idol.
So Elizabeth is your lock winner?
That's exactly what I said. Yeah, yeah, we'll go with that.
That's what I heard. All right. So let's get into a couple of these other scenes that we kind of skipped over in jumping to the Island of Idols. A couple other people we met, I suppose. On the purple team, we see Jason, the lawyer, former law school student. Jason goes idol hunting early on, and everyone seems to notice, specifically Dan, who gave a confessional that I thought was quite funny, especially seeing how the rest of this episode would play out for Dan in particular later on, where he says about Jason, quote, "He's done. It's over. It's impossible for Jason to dig himself out of that grave." Dom, I suspect it is not impossible.
Yes, it's possible that Dan, from his much deeper grave, maybe has a warped perspective on things here.
Yeah, let's talk about that other scene with Dan, because this is, we've seen similar things in previous seasons, but I don't feel like we usually get this sort of thing in premieres where this is one of the most uncomfortable scenes, I'm going to say, in recent Survivor memory, where we hear about Dan potentially being a little too touchy-feely with some of the people on the tribe, particularly Kelly here, who is not super in love with how kind of handsy Dan has been to this point. What did you think of how all of that ended up playing out, Dom?
Yeah, so when you say we've seen scenes like this before, I don't feel like we have that often, and not that they don't happen, but I feel like usually it's something which is never really broadcast or acknowledged, and you only hear about it in these like deep dive post-game interviews or in, you know, the rumors afterwards. So to see it just be out in the open, and then to see Kelly just like handle it very forthrightly while also taking care in a social game not to offend Dan's delicate sensibilities, that was kind of a surprise to see, really.
Yeah, the kind of uncomfortable things that I was thinking of just in the back of my mind to prevent me from calling this unprecedented were actually from another guy named Dan on Worlds Apart. I feel like he got similar treatment a few times over the course of that season, where just an entire scene was dedicated to making him look like a total creep and weirdo, but I agree with you, what you said about Kelly. I thought she crushed how she handled this and came out of this looking really good as far as I could tell. And I feel just because of the way she handled something as delicate as this, I feel really good about her as a player within the game. My overwhelming takeaway here, Dom, is this may be the earliest Dunn chain we've ever issued here. I feel very comfortable putting the Dunn chain on Dan. And for any new listeners, the Dunn chain is completely ripped off from a different podcast called Pardon My Take. And rather than just quietly ripping them off, I would rather just give credit where it's due. The Dunn chain means this person's season is basically over, and Dan is going to be the first recipient.
I don't think you could quietly rip them off even if you wanted to, but it is good to see that you are being open about your plagiarism here.
All right, so there goes that scene with Dan. I guess we'll see how that ends up playing out. Are you seeing this being a long-term storyline, or is this setting us up for why Dan is an early boot?
I think this is a one-and-done storyline, but I can see this being the first piece of proof for why Dan is inevitably going to go crashing and burning at some point in this game. Uh-huh. Likely sooner rather than later, I imagine. But also, if you told me there's someone on the season who is going to have just no concept of boundaries early on, it's going to be the Hollywood talent manager who looks and acts like Dan, right? Like that's that's usually the way these things go.
It seems like at least these last couple of years or so, not a great run here for the Hollywood older guy when it comes to this sort of contact and things of this nature, but probably not anything we need to get further into on a Survivor podcast at this point, Dom. We also hear a bit from Ronnie at this point. Poker player Ronnie is nervous about Elaine being a big long-term threat, and he just wants to put out good vibes and be good vibes, Ron. Meanwhile, Elaine, after they talk and try to, at least on the surface, make peace, she gives us a confessional about how she knew immediately that Ronnie's a total weasel and he's got to go.
Yeah, I feel like if you have to tell people that you are good vibes, Ron, then I'm not sure how good the vibes are really going to be. You know, that's you have to show rather than tell there.
Yeah, I mean, as we get into what went wrong for Ronnie here, this conversation stood out to me in terms of something I remember when we interviewed Sophie Clark years and years ago. She said about Albert, another professional poker player in Survivor, that a lot of his interactions, even if he didn't intend it to be this way, came across as kind of transactional, or that he, even if he wasn't overtly trying to manipulate you, his body language and tone kind of gave off that vibe. And I got a similar kind of vibe from Ronnie during this scene. And I will happily grant that this is not going to be an episode that is going to show us any of Ronnie's highlights from these first 3 days. They're going to explain why Ronnie was the first one out.
There were quite a few favorable Albert comparisons preseason, people getting very hyped up Over Ronnie, but I feel like we now see the downside to those comparisons too. Like we see, you take the good with the bad, and as you said, with Ronnie, we basically just took all of the bad and none of the good.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm happy to grant that, as I'm sure both Ronnie and Albert are aware, Survivor is a game that is loaded with variants, and it's certainly possible that this was just like a bad starting tribe for someone like Ronnie, and maybe under different circumstances. I said maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll save that for when we get into just kind of parting thoughts on Ronnie, because I do think there is an interesting discussion to be had about the Ronnie types out there on Survivor. But let's hit the rest of this episode before we end up doing that. I'm scrolling through. Oh, I guess we skipped over Jack and Tommy, I guess, on this purple tribe that I think we saw a bit less of. And I came into this rewatch of this episode still not really knowing everyone's names, but I did know that a lot of people that I talked to about Survivor were thirsting real hard after someone named Dean after the premiere, and I didn't know who Dean was. And so as I was rewatching this, I got to the scene of Jack and I was like, oh, is this Dean? And then it wasn't Dean. And then I got to the scene of Tommy and I was like, is this Dean, the lovable fourth grade teacher? Still not Dean. Turns out Dean is the only person in this entire episode who didn't get a confessional.
Right. So there was a scene where Aaron and Ronnie were standing together talking, which already is confusing enough. I got the two of them mixed up several times over the course of the episode, which thankfully will no longer be a problem. One of them is gone and the other one may be following shortly. So that's going to be off the board. But the two of them were standing together and then suddenly this blonde white guy who I had never seen before just popped up into the frame. His head was like darted into the shot. And I was like, who are you? Are you like a production assistant? Are you what's going on here? I think that's Dean. I'm pretty sure that assuming that's even the right tribe, which I think it is. I'm pretty sure that's Dean, but don't quote me on that.
I guess we'll find out. TB Dean on who Dean really is. But what did you have any takeaways on Jack or Tommy at this point?
I like them both a lot. Yeah. From Tommy, I got some of that same possibly transactional vibe where someone is openly boasting about, I am now going to go out and play the social game. And often those people are a lot more slimy than they seem to think they are. But with Tommy, it actually seemed mostly sincere-ish and people seem to be eating it up. So I guess a good sign for Tommy there.
Yeah. And we see kind of this core group come together, at least on paper here in an episode where they don't actually even have to go and vote. I know Jamal was floating around in there and we saw a little from him, and I really liked what we got to see from him. A little more from Molly, I think she was involved in this group. And then a person that seems like could be an interesting figure next week based on the next time on Survivor is Nora, whose name I first of all hope I am pronouncing correctly, just because she spells it differently than Nora Durst and other Noras that I have seen. Nora Jones spells it a bit differently than both of them.
Also differently from Nora on Are You the One, who seems equally unhinged, but this one in kind of a good way.
Don't you ever speak badly about Nora from Are You the One, my friend.
I don't need to. I have enough people to do that for me. It's fine.
All right. We can't go down that rabbit. We're already making horrible time here. But Nora is looped in on this plan from the big group. And again, that doesn't end up mattering yet because they're going to win the immunity challenge. But this is when everyone's kind of discussing, oh, Jason was off looking for the idol. Nora here goes and tells Jason, hey, everyone's been throwing your name around, and that may be something to be slightly nervous about. So we didn't get a ton of development on how this may play out, but again, I guess mostly based on that confessional from Dan about how done Jason absolutely is, it seems to me like Jason is going to be a storyline, and I would guess at this hour that he's going to survive at least one vote.
Yeah, and I love the specificity of her reason as well. It's not just, oh, well, I kind of like Jason and I don't want to work with him. It's, he reminds me of an ex I used to have who was very authentic, and therefore, like, as if that's going to mean anything to anyone else the way it does to her.
Well, in fairness, Dom, when I see people who look like you, I just immediately hate them and assume they want the worst for me.
Well, I'm sorry you still have that lingering trauma.
I think it's because the only people that really look like you with whom I'm familiar are you and Draco Malfoy. So it's not a really inspiring group in terms of people looking out and having my back. But yeah, so this I'm sure will become a bigger story whenever this tribe ends up having to go to a vote, if they end up having to go to a vote as they are currently constructed. But it does seem like at least some possible divisions already forming here on the purple team, and that leads me into a question I don't have the answer to, but we'll frame this as casual Dom thinks. Dom, what are the tribe names on this season?
Well, okay, so there's can I go with orange and purple, or do I have to be
We will be going with orange and purple for the duration of the preseason portion, as is custom here on this podcast. But for the historical record, I want to say...
Okay, give me Lyro and Vokai, something in that region.
Yeah, one of them starts with an L and one of them starts with a V. They're both five letters, and I think the purple one is the V tribe.
Okay, good to know.
That's the best I got for you. So, all right, I guess let's get into the immunity challenge here. Dom, I hope you're sitting down. It is an obstacle course followed by a puzzle. And before we even get into the specifics of this challenge, it was a story I was tracking all last season, just how repetitive these challenges have gotten in terms of format. And I get that in the opening episode, this is the standard thing and always has been for years, but it does feel like, based on these last few seasons, we are in store for pretty much nothing other than obstacle course followed by either a puzzle or a carnival game or some sort of balance slash endurance challenge for pretty close to every single immunity challenge all season. Last season, it was 13 out of 14 were explicitly those two things, and the 14th one was just a carnival game instead of a puzzle at the end. Dom, I will generously set the line at 1.5 challenges for immunity this season that are not either obstacle course plus puzzle or balance slash endurance.
Yeah, not a good early sign here, but there was a lot more originality in the actual immunity idol itself, which I thought looked really cool this time. It had those Easter Island style heads on it.
I don't think I noticed what the immunity idol looked like. Right. I'm sorry. Well, did you know? I saw this on. I don't read Reddit, but I do follow the Reddit / mildly interesting account on Twitter that posts things from that subreddit onto Twitter, because I'm on Twitter. I'm infinity percent more than I'm on Reddit. Anyway, did you know the Easter Island heads have bodies buried underneath the ground?
No, but now that's just ruined my wow. Okay,
it's incredible. Look up the recent tweets, I guess, to date this podcast from or the front page of like Reddit / mildly interesting. It is really cool. They have full bodies buried completely underground.
Is that cool?
I think it's cool.
Or is that highly disturbing?
I think it's like a real life version of shit that would go down on Lost.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Anyway, fine. Dom. All right. So in this immunity challenge, I guess there's not much of note other than this puzzle at the end where they have to put together the six huts is actually like a mini replica of what they will later see as their tribal council set. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's something that I didn't pick up upon. So between the two of us, we can get just about, I don't know, 80% of the episode.
Once again, I did not pick up on it. I just saw someone else tweet it and thought that would be worth noting. The orange team basically collapses on the puzzle. The purple team is going to win, and orange is going to go to tribal council. We talked through the island of the idols already, but before we get into the vote, Dom, before we get to tribal council itself, I guess we can talk through just kind of the dynamics on this orange tribe, and then I will ask you what I was about to ask you about the tribal council situation. But we have already heard about this Vince, Tom, and Elaine group kind of on the outs. We've seen Ronnie and Elaine kind of butt heads, and now we're seeing Ronnie and Aaron trying to bring in this group of, or, you know, rally a group of, like, Karishma, Missy, and Vince seem to be the people they're working on, and they're hoping to pull in Elizabeth whenever she gets back. And the plan is to vote against Elaine. Karishma is kind of torn because she's being pulled this direction, but she's already sworn her loyalty to Elaine and the rest of the women. Vince is also not thrilled about this plan to vote out Elaine. And so for me, based on what we had seen at this point, I was having a hard time seeing anyone other than Ronnie leaving at this tribal council, but it sounded like the takeaway in general was that it was kind of a surprising vote. Where were you on that?
Yeah, I also don't know who else the Aaron and Ronnie duo could really have targeted from the other team, right? Because it felt like there was no obvious weak link, or there was no other person who was not really fitting in, but just somehow got assimilated into the majority or something. It felt like everyone got along well, was kind of on the same page. And so if it wasn't Elaine or Vince, then who's third in line?
I feel like Ronnie and Aaron are, among the many mistakes they probably made over these first few days, the type of people who, when you are on day one on Survivor as a contestant in the game, if a Ronnie or Aaron type, or anyone, frankly, who has a six-pack is playing the game aggressively, I feel like that is viewed as much more threatening than someone less physically imposing playing the game really hard.
I could see that, especially when usually those physically strong types don't have a need to play the game that hard early because they're usually safe barring their own self-destruction.
Who is in the best, like, who has the hardest body of the people who have won Survivor? I get, like, it's not like JT would be like the big Tyson, maybe, in terms of people who have gotten away with playing a pretty active game despite being blatantly shredded. Oh, Jeremy is the obvious answer. It's Jeremy.
There's Jeremy. I think I would say Rob from this season of Survivor South Africa would make a strong case for it too. But really hard to fault Jeremy is the answer.
Yeah, Jeremy. As soon as I said the word shredded, I realized it was Jeremy because I've used that word to describe him so many times.
But it is worth noting that that was Jeremy on an All-Star season where he consciously withdrew and was not playing the game super aggressively early on, already at any point.
A season where everyone went into it knowing, or at least thinking they knew, despite what Jeremy may look like on the outside, I don't need to be that worried about him as a player.
Yeah, that too. So when it is a totally blank slate, I think the whole thing is different. I wonder maybe if Ronnie, when he decided he was going to work with Aaron, should have let Aaron go out there and do the dirty work so that if it worked, he could hide behind Aaron, which I think is where he wants to be anyway. And then if it doesn't work, he can also hide behind Aaron, who's going to be the one taking all the bullets for him instead.
Right. I completely agree with that. And kind of what I was potentially going to conclude in terms of the approach to take, if you are one of these guys who is going to be viewed as such a big physical threat early on, and people may just have this preconceived notion that you're just like this alpha bro and not be super thrilled about you coming and scheming super hard right away, is I feel like it is potentially the case that for such a person, the move is to just talk as little as possible. And I know a huge piece of the early game is bonding with people, and I think talking about your own like personal life or whatever is fine, but I really do think there is a lot more downside in being one of the like the overt kind of people being viewed as probably more aggressive in general. If you just like hang out, I think that is a far better plan than trying to actually get a whole lot accomplished on your own.
Yeah, Ronnie can talk about his 15 different jobs that he's had across his life, and there's more than enough to talk about without getting deep in the weeds on the game so early.
Yeah, I would give that advice to basically no other personality type, I guess, on Survivor. I think it's crucial to be in there developing bonds early and making sure people feel comfortable talking to you. But and maybe I'm being super results oriented here because I've seen how it went for Ronnie and potentially Aaron going forward here. but I would imagine if they literally didn't say one word, they would have been in a better situation than they found themselves in by trying hard.
Right. Well, let's talk about not just the ripped guys, but also the poker players who seem to have a historically atrocious track record now on Survivor. It's getting to the point where I think if you're someone going out there who needs to or feels the need to disguise their actual job for whatever reason, you should probably just say that you're a poker player, right? Because no one's going to take you seriously or view you as any kind of threat. Like if Tommy decides, well, I don't want people to know I'm a teacher because that's a job that's held in high esteem and they're going to see me as a social threat, he can just say he's a poker player and it'll all be fine.
Yeah, definitely don't have to worry about any poker players going forward.
Right. Well, what do you think it is, though? Because a lot of the ones who get cast are like that they're very smart, very highly capable. They've proven they can succeed in quite difficult endeavors, but they get out there on Survivor and they just melt down. They just disintegrate. Even the ones who like physically are very strong, they're very smart. There's just something lacking there, which there's some crucial ingredient that's never present.
Yeah, So, for anyone new to the podcast, like Ronnie, I play poker full-time based in Boston, Massachusetts. I think Ronnie's out west now. But this is basically why I would never do Survivor, is I feel like poker, and I think this is generally a very good thing in life and leads to success for poker players in other areas, not Survivor, but being successful in poker requires essentially training your brain not to think like a human, and to think in more in like ranges, distribution of possible outcomes and things like that. And always be really like cold and rational and thinking in terms of equity, I guess, is the bottom line in terms of what is going to improve my chance of maximizing my profit here. And I think an issue that I would imagine Ronnie ran into, I'm sure Garrett ran into this, I know Albert ran into this at Final Tribal Council at the very least, is the way, I'm guessing, they view the game and the way they view what other people consider their own best moves is starkly different from the way people like Elaine are actually going to be out there thinking about this game. And I certainly don't mean to make that sound like disparaging towards Elaine. I'm not trying to argue that like Ronnie had the right idea here or anything. I just do think there is absolutely an issue. And I run into this myself all the time in real life. In when you play poker full time, you just start thinking in completely different terms than you ever did before.
Yeah, I think the other thing too is that for a lot of the ones who end up getting cast, and I'm thinking especially of Garrett here, but equally applies to Albert, and I'm guessing to Ronnie as well, they are so used to just like going full throttle at something and at like optimizing every aspect of their life or really like pushing themselves very hard to the point where they expect everyone else to kind of fall in line and do the same thing and maybe judge them a little bit if they don't. And so they get into this spot where they can't enjoy the luxuries that they've worked hard for and become accustomed to. And they're in this environment, which is explicitly about deprivation and about having to make do with less and just, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You can't just get up from the table and leave if you're bored after day one, right? You have to stick it out for the whole duration. And it's just hard for them to take their foot off the pedal and just to relax and ease into it and just treat it like a normal human experience, even though it's anything but.
I also think there is an element of, not just on Survivor, but certainly in the context of Survivor, certainly the producers and the editors, and I'm guessing a lot of the people who play the game themselves, are the idea of serving comeuppance to some hotshot who thinks he's so smart is often very appealing to people. It's a storyline. It feels like we go through at least a couple of times per season on Survivor, and any professional poker player is certainly going to have that working against them.
Also, I think the way that casting has to look at this. You're going to get the Alberts and the Garretts and the, I guess, the Adams from Australian Survivor. You're going to get the type A personalities. You're not going to get the other stereotype of poker players, which is maybe the complete opposite, where it's the kind of like lanky, shy guy in a hoodie who never makes conversation at the table, only knows how to shuffle his chips or whatever. Those people are going to be necessarily shut out of the casting process. Right. So they might suffer for other reasons. They might fail to fit in or feel anxious or whatever. But you're not going to get them. You're only going to get the other extreme, and you're unlikely to get the happy medium. There are quite a few players I know who are just like very normal, straightforward people, but just happen to be very smart, very high functioning, and who I think would do very well out there on Survivor. But their personality and casting priorities do not align in the way that would need to happen for them to get out there and dispel that perception of their career.
Right. I think, sorry for people, which is going to be pretty much everyone who does not know this name, but like, I think someone like Phil Galfond could crush yes. Survivor, but they would never put him on Survivor. And it's unfortunate that it seems like yet just another area where poker players go out there and just constantly look bad. And that's, I think, like one of the...
Well, we know what needs to happen. You need to get out there and put some respect on that name.
Again, if I had even wanted to, which I never have, before this episode, I would definitely not want to do it now. But I am hoping that someday in the future we can get, like, a Jason Somerville type. Something like I think Jason could absolutely crush it, and he would be someone they would potentially be interested in. But it really is unfortunate, I would say, that this just seems to be like yet another thing where poker players just get clowned on and made to look like morons. So that kind of sucks.
Poor poker players, so hard done by. It's really a tough existence.
You'd think they'd be so much better. They're professional gamers.
Whatever that counts for, yeah. So here's my question. We know that Ronnie, even when he wasn't a Survivor fan explicitly, was vaguely familiar with Boston Rob. What are the odds that Boston Rob knew the name Ronnie Bardo or knew that that was the Ronnie that he saw out there?
I have no idea. So full disclosure, I had heard the name. I do not follow tournament poker at all. Like up until this most recent one, I think the last main event that I had watched was like Peter Eastgate winning it in 2008 or something. Like I have been so checked out of the world of tournament poker, but I did know of the name Ronnie Barda, and when I Wikipedia'd him, I realized why. He has the all-time record for consecutive World Series of Poker main event cashes. They were just all during years that I wasn't paying any attention whatsoever to the main event, but he is definitely a known commodity in the poker world. So what was the question? Sorry. Oh, does Boston Rob know him? I think it's at least possible. Sorry. Yeah, I think it's at least... I would say it's far more likely he knows the name Ronnie Barda than that he would just recognize him.
I love that you're not paying attention to anything I say and just going on some like freewheeling dialogue that will take you wherever you want to go.
What I mean, as if that's anything new for this podcast.
No. Well, again, you're catering here towards the new listeners, and I'm just glad that they're given a taste of what they can expect.
There are no new listeners left at this point in the podcast.
Whose fault is that, Colin?
Largely mine. I will take the blame, but I'm going to say this is just yet another poker player getting buried by the edit. All right. So, yeah, any other thoughts, I suppose, on why poker players are so bad at Survivor? Dom, do you have any big theories?
I don't know. I feel like you're giving us all the proof we need.
Okay, thank you. Tribal Council itself, I thought didn't have a ton noteworthy other than Boston Rob and Sandra being there watching all of that go down. What did you think of their little viewer box?
Oh, I loved it. And I know that they said in one of the behind the scenes things that they had to construct the whole of Tribal Council around that tiny structure, because otherwise it's either going to stand out or they don't want to risk it being unstable or whatever. It needs to just be nestled up there, you know, in the rafters for them to have a good view of things.
So hang on, explain to me how this is going to work once the secret is out about Boston Rob and Sandra. Are they still going to just pretend that no one knows and put them in that little hut?
Yeah, the secret that they are there on an island will be out. The secret that they are there at Tribal Council will not be, I imagine.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, What I don't know is if, when the jury begins, if the jury members will have any inkling at all that Rob and Sandra are there, or if they get let in on the joke, or I can actually see, and this makes more sense the more I think about it, that Rob and Sandra will be allowed to join the jury themselves at the end and cast a vote, which I believe if you look at that manifesto or whatever, the constitution for the Island of the Idols, I believe it's worded in such a way that it doesn't exclude that possibility. So,
it says we will not vote.
Yeah, but they don't vote at tribal council until the final tribal council, where maybe, you know, because it's categorically different.
I think if it said we will not vote people out of the game, that would be the wording that could get them a jury vote. But it says we will not vote.
Well, stay tuned on that. I'll take some action.
And to be clear, I agree with you. I think it is very much possible that Boston Rob and Sandra are given jury votes, unless it's like a foregone conclusion and it's not going to change anything.
Yeah. So I think that's a lock, but I imagine their little cubbyhole at the top will be kept secret until the very end.
That is a good point. Yeah, you're right. That even if everyone knows they're out there, they don't know they're at tribal council.
It might even be that after all of the regular jury members cast their votes, that they descend from their perch and announce themselves to everyone there and then cast the votes themselves.
That would be good. So Queen Stays Queen here, Dom. Better Know an Episode Title. This is not an officially sanctioned Better Know an Episode Title. This is a segment that we do on the Patreon podcasts, which incidentally, if you are interested, and I can't imagine why you would be at this point, but we do bonus episodes every week talking through classic reality seasons over at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. A lot of old seasons already in the books over there, plus plenty of other patron exclusive content like season 40 drafts, things of that nature. One more time, patreon.com/Dom and Colin if you would be interested in that. Better Know an Episode Title, though, unofficial. I Vote You Out and That's It. And this episode title, of course, is from Sandra, who, even though she's not an active contestant in the game, is still giving the most quotable confessionals.
Yeah, Sandra has what I'm going to call the Bryce effect, where she can just say, like, a very normal humdrum routine sentence, but the way she said it means that everyone out there just loses their minds. Their sides split, peals of laughter. It's the funniest thing they've ever heard.
Yes, I think that is well put. So one thing I saw flagged up, and we don't need to get too much into this right now, and I don't think it's been an issue to this point, but I could see it being an issue going forward, that the commentary we see from Rob and Sandra may be the biggest giveaway in terms of which players we should be on the lookout for, because it seems very unlikely that Boston Rob and Sandra are going to be just like clowning on any eventual winner.
And I think it is worth getting into that now, because that could be a recurring theme and a crucial theme throughout the season, because Jeff has never made it a secret, especially in recent years, who his favorites are on any given season, but his role as the host means there's necessarily a level of distance between him and the players there. He can ask tribal council questions or make comments or whatever that reveal his biases, but he's never going to come outright and say, I'm, you know, that person's really smart, or I'm cheering for this person, or anything like that. Whereas Rob and Sandra have complete freedom to do that, basically. They're just there editorializing on the game, and because of their pedigree and their reputation, not just in general, but the way it's going to be built up within this season, their views are going to be taken as gospel, I think, by a large swathe of the audience. And so if they decide that they like someone, or they don't approve of the way someone's playing, I think that's going to guide opinions in that direction, first of all, but also be taken as a somewhat official stance on who we should be rooting for and who actually is playing a game that's worthy of $1 million.
Yeah.
So when we dive briefly into the edit zone shortly, I think that's going to be a central focus. It's, well, this person maybe didn't have a big week, but at Tribal Council, we had this subtitle comment from Rob saying that he thinks that person's smart. How do you weight that against all of the usual concerns? And I think that's going to be a thing that comes up week after week.
Yeah, I do think the heavy implication, and I'm going to take full blame for this season happening in general, and for this being the case, because for coming up on 8 years now, I have spent way too many hours talking about how among the people considered to be like all-time Survivor royalty, the most fraudulent in that group in terms of perception about how good they are as game players versus how, for my money, how good their actual process is in the long run in general are easily Boston Rob and Sandra. And now, of course, we are getting an entire season dedicated to the idea that Boston Rob and Sandra have both solved Survivor, and everything they say is gospel that should be taken as this is the right way to do it.
And depending on how season 40 goes, we might get two consecutive seasons of that as well.
Yeah.
Which feels all the more likely now that Boston Rob and Sandra will have been working so closely together for 39 days. It's the natural majority alliance is going to be them plus, I guess, Rob's wife, but then also whatever hangers on they can find to join that group.
Yeah, I actually, one theory that not even I am willing to float as any kind of legitimate call that I want to make, but I think it would be great. And this first episode had one such instance of if they were weaving in things that after we see season 40 are going to be hilarious in retrospect into season 39, like say it is a situation on season 40 where Sandra just very coldly turns on Boston Rob and says, fuck no, I vote you out. That's it. And then
yeah.
I think that'd be incredible if that was how it ended up playing out.
Oh, I would love it in a way if we have most of a regular season here and hopefully a good season, but then just this side plot or subplot of set up for season 40 and whatever colossal betrayal ends up unfolding there.
They should just bring in a different season 40 contestant along with Rob and Sandra every week, and then by the end of the season they're all out on their new beach ready to start season 40.
But that's how you achieve this continuous gaslighting that I was mentioning earlier. Of the Elizabeth goes out there and she meets Boston Rob and Sandra, and then the next person goes out there and there's just a giant head of Tyson or something, and then you just get this new cycle week after week.
Yeah, that would be pretty amazing if this was like they're just Joe Schmoing someone for the opening trip to the island. All right. So the only other thing I wanted to ask you, Dom, to follow. Go for it.
I was going to say, so while we're on the subject of conspiracies, going back to your theory about Elizabeth, just because I forgot to mention this at the time, do you think if she is being told you can't lie about this, is she also allowed to come back and say, I'm not allowed to tell you anything?
No, I would imagine she I don't think that would ever be something she would realistically consider, whether she's allowed to lie or not. And again, I don't think it's them explicitly saying, if you tell them about this, we won't pay you any money. I think it's just they are so strongly suggesting that this is what she should do, that they're going to do it. And again, if I found myself out there, I honestly think it is as certain as I am that the absolutely correct thing to do is go back and obviously tell your tribe everything you can. Everything possible about what actually happened on Island of the Idols. I also think it is probably the single worst move you could make to defy production like that early on and say, fuck off, I'm not doing it. There is, if that is your response to them, you are drawing completely dead to win this season. And that is pretty much why I wouldn't go on Survivors, because I'm sure there is no scenario where I wouldn't scream at producers every 2 days.
Whether it was warranted or not, yeah.
Barely warranted, but I would still do it.
But equally, I can imagine them saying, well, look, Elizabeth, we're not telling you what you have to do, but also, right. You know, you saw what we did to Dean already. So, you know, if you want to have an edit on the season, then it might be worth towing the line.
To be clear, I agree. They are not saying, Elizabeth, we are telling you what you must do. I think with her and with everyone who follows for as long as they can pull it off, they will be doing everything under the sun to make them feel like this is something they should do. And were they not doing that, this secret would already be out.
Okay, fine. Let's move on.
Okay. I was trying to move on, and then you brought it back up.
Yeah, anyway. So what were you going to say to me before I so rudely interrupted?
Based on last season, I want your call on the record. Will there be a previously on as we begin episode 2?
Hmm. I'm going to say no. I'm going to state my claim to that.
I'm going
to
say yes. I think the premiere is one where they would do a recap, although going forward, I would guess that the Previously On continues to be something that, at least occasionally, doesn't exist.
I take it back. I agree with you. However, for episode 3, I am back on my bullshit. I am fully committed to there being no Previously On whatsoever.
I agree with episode 3, so... Alright, Dom, I guess with all of that out of the way, let's get into the edit zone a little bit. For anyone new to the podcast who has inexplicably made it this far, we know a lot of people are kind of averse to incorporating the editing techniques and so forth into how they look at the season going ahead. We are not those people, but for anyone who is such a person, now would be the time to tune out, because we are going to dive into some of the more nuanced things that at least could be worth having on our radar to this point. So this is the edit zone. In case you want to get out, now is, again, the time to do so. Please don't at either of us if you made it past this point and are unhappy with anything that we say going forward, but I think now enough time has passed that we can dive in. Dom, who stood out to you, I'm going to ask? Who's your number one contender at this point?
So I didn't think there were that many people who jumped above the pack for me. You can say Elaine was an early and obvious fan favorite, and she was, but that may turn out to just be the fan favorite edit or a big character rather than an actual winner story taking shape. Beyond that, there were so many people in this episode who we didn't see much of. What we saw looked really good, and I'm excited to see more of them, but I have no reason to put them above all the other people that I'm saying the same thing about, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like Jack and Tommy, or Molly and Elizabeth, and there are lots, even like Jamal or whatever. Like there are lots of people like that who had one kind of small good moment, and that was it, and they didn't get more than their fair share or less. They were just there, and we're going to have to see what transpires with them. Are there people who, I guess, to look at it from the other direction, are there people who you're counting out already beyond Dan? I think we can take that for granted.
There's no one I'm counting out beyond Dan, just because I can't imagine we live in a world where an eventual winner gets that as our introduction to him. Even Dean, who was the one person without a confessional, you know, after Chris Underwood last season, based on one episode, I'm still willing to say anything is possible. But incidentally, actually, by the way, I saw on Twitter recently, like an hour ago, that, or more than an hour ago, an hour before we started this podcast, that...
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah. That this was the first time in history that 21 people got a confessional in the history of Survivor in one episode. Could shout out to at Rob's Fact Checker for that fun piece of trivia. And Dean was the one person who didn't get one. So I would say if I had to pick someone who was in the worst shape going forward, I still don't even know if I would go with besides Dan. I still don't know if I would go with Dean, but he would be in consideration just because of being the one person randomly left out. The one who stood out to me, and maybe I'm just reading too much of a casual at reading the edit now, but I thought Elaine really stood out as looking really good and really likable and on top of the game, and, you know, got herself out of a dire looking situation, which I think is important. I think the people like Elaine and like Vince, potentially like Jason, if he can get himself out of this, people who are made to look like they got off to a really rough start, but then were able to recover from that because they're heroes like every other person who wins Survivor. I think those are people to always be on the lookout for, and combining that with such a focus on the women of the season early on, I feel like I can't have anyone other than Elaine as my number one contender at this point.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a bold call.
Maybe it's too, maybe that's just the super level one read of this, but that's where I'm at.
How do you feel about Elizabeth?
Feel good about Elizabeth. Feel good about Chelsea and I feel, like you said, I feel at least good enough about pretty much everyone. Dan is the obvious dungeon of this week, but other than lack of visibility, I wouldn't say anyone stood out as having actively negative episodes besides Dan, obviously Ronnie, and I think Aaron to a certain extent.
Okay, yeah, we haven't mentioned Kelly, but she's also in that bundle of people who,
totally.
Who is really in the mix at the moment. Beyond that, I'm not sure who to even bring up. How do you feel about Sandra's chances this season?
better than Dan's.
You think she's going to make it 3 out of 4?
Better. I would certainly book Sandra against Dan in a must-win bet at this point.
Yeah, just on the 1% chance that the producers are completely lying to us, because as you've informed us, that is totally in their range. Mm-hmm. And Rob and Sandra will be charging into the game at some point. You know, they'll hit the big red Dan button at the merge and come in themselves. I think both of them, I would take them in a heartbeat over Dan at this point.
No question. The theme really just for me is, I love this cast. They all looked really fun. They all looked like they're there to play. Janet, just rolling through some of these other names that look good. Janet, I thought, looked awesome. We talked a little bit about her earlier making the fire and being really having a really insightful confessional, I thought. We didn't see a ton from Jamal, but he seemed to have certainly a strong enough idea of what he was doing out there. Tommy, I actually thought, was interesting, because we heard him talk about having this girlfriend that he's about to propose to, and that really stood out to me. And maybe that's just the latest iteration of, oh, Joe Anglim mentioned Sierra, and that means she must be there for the loved one's visit, which obviously does not come in. But it does seem like we are probably going to see more develop of Tommy and this girlfriend that he's about to propose to. And I am offering you, Dom, the wager of, by finale night, will this girlfriend be proposed to?
God, I'm going to say no, but I feel like you're setting a trap for me here.
Actually, she may have already been proposed to, now that I'm thinking about the timing on this. This was filmed a while ago.
Yeah, possibly contingent on the outcome here of whether Tommy is now a millionaire or not, but not going to speculate about that any further.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to guess that they would not include this unless she had already said yes.
Well, we had the Wendell and Nicole thing, and Wendell went on to win. So,
and again, to go back to that, I really believe that we would have seen a much different story about Wendell and Nicole had they not broken up between filming and airing. Like, I think, according to all reports, he was talking about her constantly. He was wearing that N necklace around his neck for the last several days. I think we would have heard a lot more about Nicole, and I think that may be potentially in some timelines what we see come in with Tommy and this girlfriend here.
That's fair. How do you feel about Tom? He's someone who I don't think we've mentioned in any capacity yet so far, but he was actually one of the bigger figures in this episode, and not just size-wise, because he is a large gentleman, but also in terms of his presence. You know, he was out there doing well in the challenges, giving lots of confessionals, forming the group together. It feels like he's going to be a big player.
So my earbud fell out for a second. I'm guessing you're talking about the hockey player whose name I don't know.
Tom.
Tom, okay. There's a Tom and a Tommy?
Look, get over it.
Oh my God.
Within a few years, we had the Sierra, other Sierra, Sarah thing all on one season. If we can survive that, we can survive anything. So
Shane, Sharn, and Shawnee on multiple seasons together.
Right. You can put up with a Tom and a Tommy. I think that's within your remit.
I'll get Tom's new name is Dom.
Great.
Yeah.
Or Vladimir, if you ask.
That's what I was about to say, is I liked him, but I also found it kind of weird how much he looked like Vlad Putin.
Yeah.
No, I did like him. I thought he, at least to this point, seemed pretty fun and like he knew what he was doing, and that's all I really want to see on the first 3 days.
There was also Vince, who I think might be fitting into that mold of the person who feels a little bit outcast at the start, or they've had a tough life story, but survives a way of overcoming their fears and finding themselves. But that person usually doesn't go on to win, but they usually make a deep run. So that's I could see Vince just ticking that box too.
I totally agree with that. He's another one who stood out, as I said, in terms of potentially looking like he got off to a rockier start than he perhaps did. Even though he got votes against him, right?
He did. He also got the official Boston Rob endorsement. I think Rob said, "I like him" at Tribal, and that was subtitled. Karishma too. I mentioned her at the top, and so fittingly we can bookend this with Karishma. She had that scene very early on that I think established her in the minds of some of the audience members, and then I think it was Sandra instead of Rob this time who said that she was smart, and Rob nodded, and we're given no reason to disagree with that. She ended up being on the outside of the vote, so she's going to need to rebound, but I imagine if Aaron is the one like flying off the handle and digging his own grave, then she might be safe for the time being. And then if she survives to a swap or she just doesn't do anything absurd, then maybe she's going to have a decent future.
Yeah.
So she might be one to watch as well. The only other person who there was like a specific thing in the episode that stuck out to me was Molly, who she was the one who called attention to Jason scampering off into the woods to search for an idol. And she had that line subtitled very clearly, just to make sure everyone saw it, of Molly, you are very perceptive, my friend, which combined with perceptiveness, I guess, that we saw from her in confessionals, I think painted a very strong picture of her too, after one episode.
I think there is a lot of reason to believe in and like the vast majority of this cast, and now I'm just nervous that there are more people that I actually thought looked good who I'm just spacing on now, because I really don't have anyone standing out too far ahead of or behind the pack at this point.
Molly also had the clam exploding on her, which is the perfect way to lead into a winner's montage.
The tried and true winner shot of having a clam explode. Yeah. Okay, so Dom, the only other thing I have is actually something I meant to bring up long ago, but a little behind the scenes. The way I do my notes for these episodes is I will be watching, and I do them on my phone now, just because I found that to be easier than sitting with my computer on my lap. And I had this thought before I got to this point in the episode, so I just put it way down at the bottom of my notes, intending to then respace it in the fitting section when it came up. Forgot to do that. So here is something that should have come up when we were talking about the Island of Idols. A little bonus content here, I suppose, for you people who've stuck around this long, that is accidentally coming up at the very end instead. But we saw this first game be fire-making against Boston Rob. What are we thinking these upcoming contests are going to be? Because it is laid out, you will have the choice to compete, and if you win, you get a reward. Is it everyone's doing fire against Boston Rob, or what are they going to be doing?
I don't know, because it makes sense when the topic in question, the subject they're studying for this this class is just fire making, right? That's a fairly natural progression there. But if it's something more abstract involving strategy or how to just treat people or anything like that, I'm not sure how that can be worked into whatever the challenge would be. So you might get just what feels like a quite disjointed clip of Boston Rob lecturing someone about how to lie to someone, and then, oh, by the way, we're now going to build a box of puzzle pieces or something.
Right. This week's game, you're going to be playing anyone but me against Sandra, and Rob will hold up a picture. And if it's a picture of someone other than Sandra, the first one to buzz in gets a point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that will be interesting to see how they come up with, like, double-digit different games that these people can play to earn advantages. Curious to see how that goes. The other kind of lingering question I've at least seen brought up, and I don't even know where I'm landing on this, because again, on Boston Rob and Sandra, it is presented. Boston Rob explicitly says, if we are going to talk the talk, we have to walk the walk. Are they really just hanging out there all day by themselves for 39 days? Because I would say it is very arguable they have already walked the walk on Survivor and don't necessarily need to be doing this to the full extent.
Well, Rob has walked the walk because he's won the game before, whereas Sandra just keeps getting voted out. And that's so, but yeah, I think as far as I know, they are just living there together alone by themselves. And Rob was supposedly very insistent on this during the casting process, that even if it was on the table, he didn't want to be ferried back to some production compound with air conditioning and food and so on between the segments. He actually wanted to be out there living a parallel experience.
Yeah, the fact that they're so adamant about it certainly makes me believe that this is indeed what's happening, but it's got to be such a weird experience for them compared to any other time that they've played Survivor, because the days on Survivor, based on all accounts, despite all of the scheming that's going on, still pass slow as hell when you have not really anything to do out there and only so many names to toss around. Combine that with there are now only two of us out here, and we have no game to play. We have nothing to do other than just be with each other. I don't know how anyone could really endure 39 days of that.
Yeah, they apparently spent most of the first few days rehearsing their segment for the first one, which makes sense when it is the first one, but as time goes on and they become more accustomed to it and they don't feel like they have to do that anymore, then yeah, because at that point they will also have run out of story to talk about if they hadn't already, so they're just going to be there living a fairly quiet existence, I think.
I mean, I guess they do both know we're about to go play season 40 against each other. We could talk about that. We know who is likely to be there.
Oh, I'm sure they've wargamed the entire season out in advance.
Yeah. I would love, and I know I'm not the first one to bring this up, but the Rob and Sandra live feeds, I'm sure, you know, everything that's left on the editing room floor that Rob and Sandra were talking about that's never going to make the episode, I'm sure is going to be more interesting than whatever plays out on season 39.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dom, anything else from you this week?
No, there was a lot, and you were a lot, but I think we just about covered everything.
Look, I'm sorry. I really, again, to go back to it, I do not want to be the negative guy who just comes in here and complains week after week. And the good news is, this cast, as we've said a bunch of times now, looks incredibly promising, and I'm hoping that that can continue to be the main story. I am just so nervous that what would have been an otherwise amazing season is going to get, I'm not going to go so far as to say ruined, but substantially detracted from by a twist that had no need to exist in the first place.
Yeah, I really can't take issue with any of that, as much as I would love to.
Okay. Well, we will see how all of that progresses, and hopefully I can be less annoying next week. Until then, thank you guys who have made it this far somehow. So we will be back with more Survivor after next week. Again, weekly bonus episodes over on the Patreon feed every Saturday, patreon.com/DomandColin. So until then, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. You can email us, DomandColin@gmail.com. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.